high roads to wealth in America has always been the acquisition and development of good, solid, income-producing real estate. In this session, we're going to talk about the key things you must know to survive, let alone succeed, as a real estate investor. Over the last 15 years, I've had the experience of being a real estate agent, a broker, and an investor, and I have bought, sold, developed, and leased more than $50 million worth of real estate in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. I've made a lot of money for myself and for others, and I hate to admit I've lost money making foolish decisions. I've also lost money making what appeared to be prudent decisions, but I got caught when economic conditions changed unexpectedly. The purpose of this session is to give you some valuable advice that you can use to generate profits more often than losses should you decide to pursue your fortune in real estate. It's based on my own experience and that of many, many real estate investors, developers, speculators, and millionaires. It will work if you will. There's probably no area of investment where more myths prevail about wealth and success than in the field of real estate. You'll hear people saying that 90% of all fortunes in America come from real estate, that they aren't making any more of it, that it is the surest route to financial dependence for the average person, and that you can buy it with no money out of your own pocket and have your tenants pay it off for you. These assertions are all partially true and partially false. Many fortunes in America are based on real estate, but that real estate was usually purchased with cash flow from another business producing valuable goods and services at a profit. These profits were then channeled into real estate as an investment. And it's also true that they aren't making any more of it. But it's also true that in many areas, real estate values are declining and have been declining for years. The fact that it is sometimes scarce doesn't mean that it's necessarily desirable, much less going up in value. It's also true that real estate ownership is one of the best ways to achieve financial independence for the average person. But in order to become a successful real estate investor, you're going to have to become very much above average in your knowledge and in your understanding of how the real estate market really works. It's also true that you can buy real estate with little or no money down and have your tenants pay it off for you. But this is a long, hard process which requires a tremendous amount of work and intelligent analysis on your part. The field of real estate is one of the most dynamic and competitive in the country, and the real estate industry includes some of the smartest, sharpest, most experienced business professionals anywhere. And every year, even in boom markets, these people, the experts, lose millions of dollars as a result of decisions and investments that turn out wrong. There's a joke about the two real estate developers who are sitting around talking about what they would do if they won $1 million in the lottery. The first one says, "Well, if I won $1 million, I'd probably buy a nice home, pay off my bills, take my wife for a trip around the world, spend some time in Hawaii, buy some nice clothes, and dine in fancy restaurants." He then asked the second real estate developer what he would do if he won $1 million. The second real estate developer thought for a while and said, "Well, I might do all the things you just mentioned, but then again, maybe I just go on investing in real estate until it's all gone." This little joke is only partially funny. Not long ago, I had a man in my office who had built an extremely successful toy company and then sold out to a major multinational firm for $35 million in cash. Everyone told him that the best place for him to put his money was into real estate and real estate development, so that's what he did. He kept on doing it for 8 years until his money was all gone. And then he went back to work as a commission salesman, starting all over again. I have friends who have been real estate millionaires and real estate bankrupts, all in a period of less than 1 year. One of my friends, an extremely experienced real estate professional, went from $7 million net worth to $3 million in the hole in less than 18 months investing in real estate. So if someone suggests to you that it's easy to be successful in real estate, don't you believe it. One of the great truths of business and of life is that there's no such thing as a free. On the other hand, it certainly is possible for you to do well in real estate if you approach it as you would any other business. Here are the five basic requirements for you to succeed in real estate. First, sit down and write out clear, specific goals and put timelines on them. Set goals for the amount of money you plan to save and invest in real estate, and for the amount of real estate that you intend to purchase in the next 3, 5, and 10 years. Then, set a schedule for yourself with deadlines on it. The very act of writing out a set of goals for yourself in real estate will make it much more likely that you achieve the success that you're aiming for. Second, write out a detailed plan of action, listing everything that you're going to do organized by time and priority. The combination of goals plus detailed plans will give you a blueprint for real estate accumulation that you can begin to follow on a day-to-day basis. Third, go to work to learn every detail of the real estate business, as we'll talk about in this session. Because the potential rewards are so high in real estate, they tend to go to those who have done their homework and paid their dues. It's very important for you to become an expert at real estate before you begin investing your time and savings in real estate acquisition. Fourth, be prepared to back your plans with hard work, sacrifice, and persistence. Going into real estate is very much like starting a business. There's a tremendous amount that you have to learn and which you can only learn by experience. There will be ups and downs, successes and reverses, and you must be willing to persist patiently throughout, knowing that you will be successful in the end. And the fifth requirement for success in real estate is to resolve to get in for the long term, for a minimum of 10 to 20 years. That is, if you are serious about building up something lasting and worthwhile in real estate. Real estate investment is not something to jump into and out of. It is something that you step into very carefully while being prepared to hold on to it for a long time. A recent study on real estate investment concluded that many people buy real estate, hold it for a long time, and then they sell it just before it starts to rise rapidly in value. They become impatient when they hear other people tell stories of how quick or easy money was made by flipping real estate properties. They then sell what is an excellent property and put the money into something that may not be as good. And often, 1 or 2 years later, the piece of real estate that they sold increases in value by 3 or 5 or even 10 times. And this is especially true with regard to raw land. So let's begin with a definition of investment real estate in its simplest terms. Real estate is its future earning power. Let me repeat that. Real estate is nothing more and nothing less than its future earning power. The value of any piece of real estate is determined by the income that can be generated by that property when it's developed to its highest and best use from today onward into the indefinite future. The value of a home is the value that a person who desires to live in that home will pay for. The value of a rental property is determined by how much people will pay to rent that property. The value of a piece of agricultural land is determined by the quality, the quantity, and the value of the crops that can be raised on that land. There are millions of acres of land throughout the United States that will never have any value, such as desert land or swamp land, because this land cannot be developed to produce income or to satisfy specific human needs. A question that you always have to ask is, when and how will income or wealth be generated on or by this piece of property? The correct answer to that question tells you how much the property is worth today and how much it's likely to be worth in the future. There are vast areas of many large cities where property values are declining because growth and development have come and gone and will probably not return in your lifetime. Every day, men and women are selling homes and properties for less than they paid for them, or are losing them to foreclosure because these properties have actually declined in earning power and therefore declined in value. Thousands of homeowners walk away from their homes each year because the value of those homes has declined to the point where the homes are not even worth the first mortgages that have been placed on them. Having said this as a warning, there are many things that you can learn and do, starting with very little money, to begin building your financial independence in real estate. If you have little money but lots of time, and if you sincerely desire to enter into the real estate field to purchase property as an owner and as an investor, the simplest way for you to start is by using the so-called Nickerson method. This is also called the buy-em, fix-em method. This is the process of buying homes that need work and fixing them up, thereby increasing their value. Here are the 6 steps you must follow to use this strategy successfully. Step 1. You do your market research and you look at houses until you find one that is underpriced relative to the neighborhood because it's run down and needs a lot of work. A house that is underpriced is one that is selling for 20% or more below what similar houses are selling for in the same area, based on the cost or sales price per square foot. Real estate agents call this type of house a handyman special, or sometimes they advertise it as a starter home needing TLC or tender loving care. For you, this type of a home could be what is called a sleeper. It can be more valuable than it appears on the outside. The second step is for you to purchase the house for the lowest possible cash down payment and get the seller to carry back a second mortgage or trust deed on the property. Your ideal purchase of investment real estate is always to get the very best price and terms. Price and terms are often more important than any other single factor. If you can get a low enough price and generous terms, you can make almost any property into a successful investment. The third step in the buy-em, fix-em method is for you to move into the house and begin working on it on the weekends to renovate it and refurbish it, doing all or most of the work yourself. Many husbands and wives have launched themselves toward financial independence by working together as a team to buy and fix up houses, approaching it as a family project. The fourth step is that when you've fixed up the house and yard so that it's attractive again, you can then do one of three things. You can, first, sell the house for more than you paid, take the profit from the sale, and buy another house to renovate. Or, two, you can rent out the house at a rate which covers your mortgage payments and perhaps gives you extra cash flow. Or, three, you can rent out the renovated house and then go to the bank and refinance the house, often for as much as you paid for it, based on the higher earning power of the property when rented out to a tenant. For example, let's say that you bought a house for $100,000. You negotiated well and you only had to pay $5,000 down. The bank would give you a first mortgage of 80%, or $80,000, and the seller would take back a second deed of trust in the amount of $15,000. You now own a $100,000 house with only a $5,000 investment. Then, you move into the house for 2 or 3 months and you spend another $5,000 on fixing up the house. You then advertise and you find a tenant who will pay you $1,200 a month in rent for this newly renovated home. You can then often go to the bank and apply for a new first mortgage in the amount of, let us say, $90,000 based on the rent that you are receiving. At normal interest rates, a $90,000 mortgage would cost approximately $900 per month to service. If the bank would agree to refinance and issue you a new first mortgage for $90,000, you would get back your $5,000 down payment and your $5,000 investment in repairs and renovation. You would, in effect, have no money of your own invested in the house at all. On top of that, if your tenant was paying you $1,200 per month, you would have a positive cash flow from that house of $300 per month with no money of your own in the deal. You could then use that positive cash flow to pay off the $15,000 second deed of trust. As you can see, if you did this once every 6 months over the next 10 years, you could end up with a cash flow of several thousand dollars per month and a portfolio of investment properties in which you had little or no investment. This is the miracle working power of the buy-em, fix-em method. In step 5 of this method, you can then repeat this process with another house, again investing your sweat equity or your human capital in the work and renovation until you fixed it up and you're ready to sell, rent, or refinance the house once more. In step 6, as you increase your assets, your cash flow, and your experience, you move up to buying and fixing duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and eventually apartment buildings, which you'll learn about later in this session. The two main advantages of this buy-em, fix-em method are, first, you can do it while you keep your full-time job, continuing to generate cash flow from your job for repairs and renovation. And second, you can start small with little or no money, little or no risk, and expand your activities as you gain more knowledge and experience. The one limitation of the buy-em, fix-em method, as I mentioned earlier, is that it takes an enormous amount of time to seek out and purchase the types of houses that are ideal for this process. But if you have lots of time and little money, this is where you can start toward financial independence. Now, let's talk about what is called buying real estate with no money down. There's no question that it's possible to buy real estate, especially older homes, with no money down. This is certainly true, but that doesn't mean that it's easy. What buying a house with no money down simply means is you find someone who is eager to sell his or her house, and who is, therefore, willing to carry back a second mortgage on the property rather than to demand cash. A person who is eager to sell a property is called a motivated seller. And finding such a seller is usually the only way for you to buy real estate with little or no money of your own invested in the property. For example, a house might be for sale for $100,000, and let us say that you can qualify for an 80% mortgage on the property. If the person selling the property will carry back a $20,000 second mortgage, then you can end up owning the house subject to the mortgages and the payments with no money out of your own pocket. If you could then turn around and rent out the house for an amount high enough to cover both mortgage payments and the taxes and any future repairs, your tenants would eventually pay off the cost of the house and you would own it with no money down. This method requires that you achieve a monthly rental rate equal to approximately 1% or more of the purchase price of the house. For example, if the purchase price of the house was $100,000, you would have to get a rent of approximately $1,000 or 1% of $100,000 per month in order to service the debt on both mortgages. This strategy only works with lower-priced houses because you can very rarely rent out a more expensive house for enough to cover all the payments. You'll want to look at houses in the $75,000 to $125,000 price range for this no-money-down purchase strategy. These are also the homes that sell the most rapidly and are the most easily rented in almost any market. If you didn't want to rent the house right away, or if the house was not yet suitable for renting, you could move in, make the payments while fixing up the house, and then you could either resell the house or rent it out for enough to earn a profit, or you could refinance the house based on its new cash flow from a new tenant paying a higher rent. Robert Allen, the famous real estate investment advisor, in his books Nothing Down and Creating Wealth, suggests that you aim to buy a minimum of one, or even better, two houses per year, with minimum or zero down payments. He suggests that unless you have a lot of time, you buy a house that needs little or no work so that you can immediately turn around and rent it out when you take possession. Allen describes what he considers to be the ideal target property or investment-grade property for you to look at. It would be described as a three-bedroom, single-family, detached house or condominium that is located in a stable neighborhood within a five-mile radius of your own home that is priced at less than $75,000 and worth at least 10% more than your cost, that you can buy with less than 10% down and with terms which allow you to rent the home out with no negative cash flow or balloon payments coming due in less than 5 years. Allen goes on to suggest that you only buy homes in the bottom end of the price pyramid. He says that's where all the demand is. Lower price properties are the easiest to rent, and they have the greatest potential for upward price movement. One of the basic rules of real estate is that you should only buy property that you can drive out and look at. The very worst real estate mistakes are made by people who buy property a long way from where they live. There are just as many real estate opportunities within driving distance of your home as there may be in another community or on the other side of the country. In looking for a house to purchase with little or no money down, there are five factors that you need to take into consideration. Factor one is the seller's motivation and flexibility. Does the seller want to sell the house in a hurry, and is the seller flexible enough to consider carrying back a second mortgage on the property? One successful real estate investor I know won't consider making an offer on a property until it's been on the market for at least 6 months or until the owners have already moved away and are extremely anxious to sell. The second factor is the location, as we'll talk about later in greater detail. The third factor is the financing or the terms. If you can get a property with the right terms, you can pay a higher price. If a house is worth $90,000 and the seller is demanding the full price, this would not normally be a bargain. However, if the seller will carry back a note for the amount above the first mortgage for 5 years, with interest only, and a balloon payment after 5 years, this then becomes an attractive purchase opportunity. The fourth factor, of course, is the price. And you're looking for a bargain, that is, a house that the seller will part with for 90% or less of the going market price. The fifth factor to take into consideration is the condition of the property. This is something that you must always confirm for yourself in detail. And again, I'll deal with this later on in this session. So, if you have a motivated and flexible seller with a house in a reasonably good neighborhood who's willing to carry back a second mortgage and sell the house at a reasonable price, and the house is in good condition, you have all the factors that you need to make an excellent real estate purchase. The best strategy for you if you're going to get into buying and renting houses as a full or part-time occupation is to aim to buy one or two houses a year for the next 10 years. During this period of time, your tenants will be making all your payments. Except in the rarest of circumstances, you should never purchase an income-producing piece of property where the debt service is not covered by the rent. In other words, you should avoid negative cash flow at all costs. A negative cash flow causes more real estate entrepreneurs to go bankrupt than any other single factor. Where do you find homes to buy for no money down? Well, you look in the classified section of your newspaper. Look for homes that are for sale by owner. If a real estate agent gets involved in the sale of a house, often having to pay the real estate commission makes it impossible for the seller to give you the price and terms that you need to make the deal work. Just for practice, you can take your newspaper any evening and begin phoning to those ads in the homes or condominiums for sale section which are for sale by owner. Ask the person who answers how much they want for the property and whether they would be willing to sell the property with a minimum or zero down payment. Often, if a person is motivated to sell for some reason, they'll accept any offer that enables them to get their full price. They'll even give you the house with no money down if you can assure them that you'll be able to make the payments that you commit to. Now, the pitfalls and the dangers in this system of buying real estate with no money down are basically as follows. First, if a house is priced reasonably in a normal market, the seller will not have to accept no money down. The seller can get cash to mortgage or refinance the house himself. Many people, when you talk to them about selling their houses with no money down, will laugh in your face and even hang up the phone. Don't worry. What you're looking for is a motivated seller, and you may have to kiss a lot of horny toads before you find the handsome prince. The second pitfall or danger in this strategy is that you must be able to generate sufficient income to make the payments on both mortgages, the first and the second, which the seller takes back, or the seller will have the right to step in and foreclose and take the house back from you. Many people who go out and find sellers willing to accept no money down end up losing both their money and their reputation when they're unable to keep up the payments. This is why it's so important for you to build up a cash reserve and never part with all your cash. The third pitfall or danger of buying real estate with no money down is that if you rent the house out to a tenant, the tenant had better be able to pay the rent or you'll have to come up with it or else lose the house. Also, your tenant must not do anything to damage the property or the value of the property will actually go down and you'll end up owing more than the house is worth. And renters do damage rental property. Sometimes they even destroy it. Thus, the importance of your selecting your tenants very, very carefully and doing a detailed check on their background references is essential. No references, no rental should be your rule. If you decide to embark on this kind of a program of real estate investment, you must take considerable care and do some research and analysis before making your investment decision. Here are four things that you'll have to learn in order to make money in real estate. First, you'll have to study the economics of the city and the neighborhood where you're thinking of investing. Some cities and some neighborhoods in some cities are in a state of decline. These are risky choices for real estate speculation. Other cities and certain parts of cities are stable or growing and are therefore good areas for investment. Second, you'll have to learn about the various factors that make a property valuable in a specific area. Why is one house more desirable than another? With experience, you'll be able to drive down the street and pick out houses that are excellent investment opportunities. Third, you'll have to learn how to evaluate and appraise real estate in order to be able to determine what kind of a price you can afford to pay. And fourth, you'll have to learn how to negotiate and how to sell people on the idea of dealing with you, especially the idea of giving you an excellent price or excellent terms or both. So let's start off with urban or city economics. What makes one city a better bet for real estate investment than another? Hold on to your seat. Here are 10 factors for you to consider when choosing a city to invest in. First, is the general level of business activity nationally? Nationwide recessions and depressions hurt all real estate everywhere. Almost invariably, nationwide recessions are triggered by rising interest rates. No matter where you are in the country, when interest rates go up, real estate values are hurt. So one of the questions you have to ask is, what is the overall national economy like today, and what do I think it's going to be like in the next few years? Second, you need to examine the level of local business activity. This is often more important than the status of the economic condition of the nation as a whole, because there are always cities, states, and regions that are growing while other parts of the country are stagnant or declining. Perhaps the most important specifics for you to pay attention to are the number of business startups and the growth rate of the local economy, especially the unemployment rate. An area that is strong has a business startup rate equal to 3 or 4% of the total number of businesses in the region. It will also have unemployment rates lower than those of the national economy. The third factor to consider is the changes or potential changes in the employment and the income sources for the community. The question is, where are the jobs now, and where will the jobs come from in the future? Is business and industry moving in or out? Are government offices and departments expanding or contracting? The single factor that has the greatest impact on the economic health of a region and its real estate values is the number of productive jobs existing and being created in the area. Wherever there is strong job creation, you have a strong economy and strong real estate values. The fourth thing for you to consider when looking at any city are the trends in financing terms and interest rates in the area. Are the terms getting better or worse? Are interest rates rising or falling? How much will you have to pay as a down payment? What kind of terms can you get? What interest rates will you have to pay both on first mortgages and on second mortgages? In some cities and in some parts of some cities, the prices, terms, and interest rates can be more favorable than in other parts of the same community. The fifth factor for you to measure when considering investing in any city is the rate of population growth or decline. A basic rule in real estate says that real estate values increase at approximately double the rate of population growth. For example, if the population increases 3% in an area, real estate values for single-family homes will increase at approximately 6%. Another rule of thumb is that real estate values increase at approximately 3 times the rate of inflation. If inflation is 3% per annum, then real estate values should increase at the rate of 9% per annum. Real estate booms take place when you have both population increase and inflation taking place simultaneously. A 3% increase in population per annum and a 3% increase in inflation per annum will equal a total of a 16% increase in residential real estate prices per annum. We've seen these factors at work for several years in places such as Los Angeles, Seattle, Miami, Tampa, and San Diego. The sixth factor for you to evaluate is the changes in the tastes and preferences of homebuyers. What kind of homes do people want now? What size? What layout? What kind of homes are they likely to want in the future? What are the trends in new home construction? Remember, you must think about any property that you're considering purchasing as though you were going to own it for the next 20 years. The future earning power of the property is what you're buying. You have to look at the property in terms of how it will measure up 5 or 10 years from now, in terms of customer tastes and preferences at that time. The seventh factor to evaluate in any community is the volume of building activity and construction cost levels, and the trends of those construction cost levels. How many new homes are being built each year relative to the absorption rate of new homes? The absorption rate is the number of new houses that are purchased for people to live in each year. If you have an absorption rate of 3,000 homes per year, and you have 3,000 homes being built, you will have a stable, if not rising, real estate market. But if you have a situation such as has happened in Phoenix, where there was an absorption rate of 8,000 homes per year and a construction rate of 12,000 to 15,000 homes per year, you're going to have strong downward pressures on both home prices and rental rates. Eventually, there will be a real estate recession. The eighth factor for you to consider in a city where you're thinking of buying a house as an investment is the vacancy rate. This is perhaps the single most important factor that influences real estate trends. When vacancy rates get below 5%, developers begin building more homes and apartments to satisfy the demand. When vacancy rates rise above 10%, developers stop building and landlords begin to lower their rental rates and increase incentives to attract tenants. Wherever you have high vacancy rates, you have a high negative factor that makes buying and renting residential real estate less desirable. The ninth factor is to look at the interrelationship between prices, rents, and construction costs. These are important to market conditions. In other words, when rents rise above a certain point, construction activity will tend to increase. When prices of real estate rise or fall above or below a certain point, construction of new residential accommodation will also decline or increase. You should familiarize yourself with these numbers and ratios so that you can be in a position to predict what's going to happen. Some years ago, I invested in a hotel in a small community. I foolishly entrusted this investment decision to my partners, all of whom were professionals in real estate. It seemed like a tremendous deal going in, but they had overlooked one important factor. The economy of the town was both seasonal and unpredictable. It was dependent on government spending to maintain high levels of employment, and economic activity was partially determined by the prices of natural resources as well. All at once, the government cut back its spending and the natural resource prices fell through the floor. The level of economic activity in the community dropped dramatically, and the hotel began sitting empty month after month. Not taking the time to evaluate these factors in advance cost me more than $100,000 in less than a year. I finally lost the hotel to foreclosure. Another relationship that you should study to keep an eye on your marketplace is the differences between the listing prices of homes and their final sales prices. In a strong market, houses will sell for between 90 and 100% of the asking price. In a weakening market, houses will begin to sell at between 80 and 90% of their asking prices. Even a 1% change in the average selling price compared with the asking price, either up or down, can be an indicator of the trend in the real estate market. If you can spot a trend before it gets going, you can make or save yourself a lot of money. The 10th factor to look at in any community is the volume of market activity that is reflected in the number of deeds recorded, the number of mortgages recorded, and the volume of foreclosures recorded at the city hall. All of this information is on public record and is available to you for the asking. The key is to compare the present level of market activity with previous levels, not only with previous years, but also with previous months. You want to be well aware of how long it takes to sell houses in different price ranges. For example, if you're looking for houses in the $75,000 to $125,000 price range, you should pay close attention to how many weeks or months it takes a house like this to sell, on average, after it comes on the market. If the selling time begins to stretch out to 3 or 4 months, you will be able to find more motivated buyers than if the selling time is only 2 weeks. And here's the rule for residential real estate investment. People pay for homes in direct proportion to how close those homes are to where they work. This also applies to apartments and office buildings. Since people spend one-third of their time at home and one-third of their time at work, they will pay a premium to be able to live with the two as close together as possible. Here's another rule. When jobs increase in a particular community, or wage levels increase in that community, or interest rates go down in that community, any of these or all three will cause housing prices and the demand for housing to go up. Your job is to be alert to the level of job growth, to how much those jobs are paying, and to the trend in interest rates. A very small bit of information can often be worth many thousands of dollars to you in buying residential real estate correctly. Here are the 7 key factors that give a city the power to grow and to enjoy increases in real estate value. Factor number 1 is the economic and political power to attract business and industry. There must be reasons for businesses to move there, to start up, and to invest and expand. Business growth leads to population growth, which leads to growth in real estate values. Economic power in a city can come from a major industry that requires a tremendous number of service industries around it, such as the Boeing Corporation in Seattle. Political power can be based on the ability to move federal or state government facilities to a particular area, as happens in states and cities that have powerful friends in Washington or in state capitals. The second factor that gives a city the power to grow is dynamic community leaders, aggressive politicians, and active entrepreneurs. What you're looking for is a city where the mayor and the council are pro-development, pro-business, and pro-free enterprise. The powerful people in the community should be strongly in favor of the community growing and prospering through economic growth and development. The third factor that gives a city the power to grow is a pool of labor, especially an educated professional labor force. This is considered the single most attractive factor that determines where new companies will locate their head offices or where they will expand. There seems to be a direct relationship between the percentage of colleges and universities in a city and the number of educated people in the workforce. Therefore, any city that has its fair share of colleges and universities is usually going to be a strong place to invest in residential real estate. The fourth factor that gives a city the power to grow is the ability to export more goods and services out of the city or region than are imported into the area. If you look upon a city as a small nation, this is called having a positive balance of payments. When a city has the ability to command income from beyond its borders or city limits, it starts to take in more money than it sends out. That extra money kept in the community will be reflected in higher real estate prices. The fifth factor is the ability to attract or generate new sources of income and employment, or new business formation. This is considered the number one variable in determining overall economic activity in a community. The average community loses approximately 8 to 10% of its jobs by natural attrition each year. Companies shut down, fold up, go broke, or move away. Because of this, the number of jobs lost, plus more besides, must be created each year in order for a city to continue to maintain a vibrant economy. The basic requirement is that there must be new business formation at the rate of 3 to 4% per annum. This means, for example, that if there are 100,000 businesses in the greater San Diego area, there must be new business formation of 3,000 to 4,000 new businesses per year for San Diego to maintain employment for its workforce and to continue growing. If the rate of new business formation falls below 3% per annum, the unemployment rate will start to go up and residential housing prices will start to soften or even decline. The sixth factor that gives a city the power to grow, and one of the most important factors to many people, is the quality of living conditions and lifestyle. People prefer to live in cities that have beautiful weather and excellent environmental conditions, such as beaches and mountains nearby. The quality of local government as well as tax levels in the community are also important. For example, the tax levels in Pima County, where Tucson, Arizona is located, are higher than the tax levels in Maricopa County, where Phoenix is located. For this reason, more businesses choose to locate in Phoenix than in Tucson, causing Tucson to continually fall below the level needed for new business formation. The primary reason why the Sun Belt areas of the Southeast and the Southwest are growing more rapidly than any other part of the country is because of the lifestyle considerations. People like to live where it's warm and sunny much of the year. In fact, as long as lifestyle is a major consideration, investing in residential real estate in the Sun Belt is a smart thing to do, if you pick the property intelligently. And here's another rule for real estate and economic decision-making that has changed my life twice and has made many people rich. The rule is this: you can make more money and more progress in 5 years in a dynamic, growing city or region than you could in 20 years in a dying city or even in a city that's leveled off, such as Chicago or Milwaukee. Earl Nightingale once told the story of a young man who sought advice from a very wealthy older man. He told the older man that he wanted very badly to become wealthy and asked him what he should do. The old man told him that it was easy to become wealthy. All he had to do was find a rapidly growing community and move there. Then, save at least 10% of everything he earned and carefully invest it in real estate around the edges of the growing city. If the young man were to do this, in 20 years he would be wealthy, as sure as he was alive. But, the young man replied, that would require that I move away from my family and friends and start over again. I can't do that. Then, said the older man, you really don't desire wealth as much as you say you do. The moral of the story is simple. There is nothing in the world that can stop you from becoming wealthy if you are willing to make the necessary sacrifices. But most people are not willing to make any sacrifices at all, much less the sacrifices that are necessary to achieve financial independence, especially in residential real estate. Here are the key factors affecting residential real estate investments. First, each property is unique. It is unlike any other. It is immovable, occupying a particular and specific spot on the Earth's surface. That's why it's said that the three key factors in real estate are location, location, location. Second, many owners have a sentimental attachment to their properties, and their ideas of value are distorted by their emotions. Homes are very emotional possessions, and often people are blind to what the house is really worth. Often, a person will set a price on his house that is determined not by what the house is really worth, but but by what he or she has heard that someone else got when that person sold his or her house. The two houses may have little in common, but nonetheless, the owner will insist on getting that price no matter what. Third, buyers for a particular house are limited to people living in or near the community, or to people who want to move into that particular area. No matter how attractive the house is, there are only a certain number of people who will be interested in that particular neighborhood in the first place. A very attractive home in a distant location will sell for far less than the same home in a growing city. The fourth factor that affects residential real estate investments is that prices are affected by the terms and availability of financing. The basic rule for purchasing a house is that people buy payments as much as they buy the house. By this I mean that people buy as much house as they can afford to make monthly payments on, as expensive a house as they can qualify for a mortgage on. Whenever there are lower interest rates, it translates into lower payments and faster sales. More people can afford the payments on more houses when interest rates are declining than when they're rising. Banks and savings and loan institutions are only allowed to lend a maximum of 80% against the value of a house, and the final amount is limited to payments that equal no more than 30% or 32% of the purchaser's gross income. In other words, if you earn $60,000 per year, you will only qualify for a mortgage that requires total payments of about $20,000 per year. Another factor that affects the value of properties is the zoning laws. Many communities have very stringent zoning laws that make it difficult to renovate or upgrade a property. Other communities have very loose zoning laws that allow people to do whatever they want to do to their properties, often to the detriment of the whole neighborhood. The sixth factor affecting residential real estate values is that the value of any specific property is influenced by the character and the appearance of the entire neighborhood and the overall economic outlook for that specific neighborhood. The seventh factor to consider is that buildings are all different. Some have hidden defects, and some have exceptionally favorable features. You should never judge by appearances alone when you're thinking of buying a house. Even if a house looks great, it may have all kinds of problems that you cannot see from the outside. Another consideration is that there may be periods of rapid turnover in a particular area and periods of stagnation and decline. Phoenix, for example, has been famous for years for having a boom and bust economy. For 3 to 5 years, the economy will be strong and homes will be going up by the thousands. Then, the economy will decline and everyone will stop building. Housing prices will level and start falling. Real estate developers and investors will go broke. If you're serious about getting rich in real estate, you should seek to invest in a stable community with a solid economic base. Avoid those communities that are known for boom and bust cycles. It's too easy to lose the results of all your hard work in an unstable economy. The ninth factor for you to consider as a residential real estate investor is that property values may be affected by the quality of police and fire protection in the area. Low crime areas are more desirable than high crime areas. Areas that are known to have good fire and police protection are more attractive to home buyers and renters than areas that have a lesser reputation. The tenth factor to consider is that property values are affected by the availability of water, sewer, gas, electricity, and the cost of those services and utilities. In some communities, they are less expensive, and in some communities, they are astronomical. Be sure you find out what it costs to run the utilities in a home that you're considering buying. Ask for the utility receipts for an entire year so that you can check seasonal fluctuations. The 11th factor, and one that is often overlooked, is that air, water and noise pollution may have highly adverse effects on a home that you purchase. One of the most desirable features of a house is that it is quiet and that it's located in a quiet neighborhood. If a house is close to a freeway or a main traffic artery, there can be a continual roar of traffic that never lets up and which makes the house less desirable. I've seen many houses that had to be sold at a steep discount because of the traffic noise from nearby roadways. Wonderfully enough, though, the good news is that if you are willing to do your homework and take your time, you can make prudent and profitable real estate purchases and sales. And here's the key rule for real estate investment. Write it down, carve it onto the outside of your checkbook. Here it is. You make your profit when you buy real estate, not when you sell. You make your profit in real estate by buying right, by buying the right property at the right price and terms, When you sell, you simply realize the profit that you really made at the time of purchase. Never forget this rule. Many inexperienced real estate investors make the mistake of operating on what is called the greater fool theory when they buy a property. They convince themselves that no matter how bad or overpriced the property is, there will always be a greater fool who will come along to rent it from them or to take it off their hands at a higher price. This greater fool theory is one of the primary reasons why so many people end up losing money in real estate or any other type of investment. Another important rule for investing in real estate is this. Don't become emotional about a property that you are purchasing for investment, even a house. Always look at the property from the viewpoint of a critical purchaser. Ask yourself, who will buy this property from me, and why will they buy it? Who will rent this property from me, and what features will they find attractive? In every real estate investment that you make, put yourself in the position of the person that you will eventually sell the property to, and look at it through his or her eyes. Now, let's look at some additional factors affecting the choice of a specific neighborhood for you to invest in. First of all, in every city growing or declining, there are neighborhoods that are also growing or declining. The patterns of growth or decline in a city are largely determined by the growth pattern of the city out from the central core. The growth pattern, in turn, is largely determined by the topography or the existence of rivers, hills, valleys, oceans, and swamps. The basic growth pattern of a city is what is called the expanding pie pattern. Imagine your city as a pie cut up into slices. As the city expands, the type of development in each slice tends to expand outward with it from the city core. If a slice starts as industrial, it will tend to continue to expand as industrial. If it starts as high-quality residential, the outer edges of that slice will tend to continue expanding as high-quality residential. Gradually, a core or dying area will develop around the central business district as people, businesses, and commercial development expand toward the suburbs. You can often pick up real estate bargains in these declining areas, but remember, you are purchasing the future earning power of the property and of the neighborhood. In a way, you're buying a share of stock in that neighborhood or area, just as you would buy a share of stock in a company. Your first job is to determine that the neighborhood is holding or increasing its appeal and attractiveness as time passes. The best way to evaluate a neighborhood is to walk through it and get a feel for it. Look for evidence that people are renovating and upgrading their properties. Listen for noise levels and look at pollution levels. Talk to the corner grocer, the person at the gas station, and especially the real estate agents with homes for sale. Take the name and phone number of every real estate agent who has a home for sale in the area that you're looking at and call them up and quiz them. Ask them every question that you can think of about the neighborhood. Usually, real estate agents are your very best source of timely and accurate information for a particular area. Learn everything you can, just as though you were going to buy a house, move in, and live there for 20 years. Because, and this is important, the profit that you can make on any home you buy will depend on someone moving in for the long term. Once you've found a solid neighborhood that you have confidence in a solid city that has a strong, diversified economy, it's time to begin looking for a house to buy and either fix up or rent. This leads to my rule of 100. Expect to look at 100 houses before you are knowledgeable enough to make an offer on the first one. Be patient. Do your homework. Shop carefully and look at everything available. Don't allow real estate agents or sellers to rush you for any reason. Wait until your research tells you that you've found the right property for you. Spend as much time researching an investment as you spent earning the money that you're going to put into the investment. The next thing to consider is the value you're going to put on a piece of property. There are three methods that are commonly used to evaluate or appraise real estate, and in some way you should learn and then take all three into consideration when making an offer. The first is what is called the market approach. How much is the house or building selling for per square foot compared to other properties of similar size, condition, amenities, and location? Remember this. If a particular feature of a house doesn't add to the value of a house, or if you can't sell the property for more money because of this feature, don't pay extra for it. This rule applies especially to things such as lot size, landscaping, paint, double garage, or swimming pool. These are what are called hygiene factors. If the house has them, they're not worth anything more. But if the house doesn't have them, then the house is worth less when compared to other similar houses. The second method of appraisal is called the cost approach, especially the replacement cost. The replacement cost is based on the current cost of construction of a home of similar size and value. What would it cost to build a home similar to this from scratch in today's market? This is a question that you have to get an answer to. Remember, buildings begin deteriorating the day they are completed. They wear out unless they're well constructed and carefully maintained. You must check out both construction and maintenance in detail when you're evaluating a property for purchase. Every error of judgment on your part, every factor that you ignore, will end up costing you money, sometimes a lot of money, somewhere down the line. The third method of appraisal is called the income approach. This is used for properties that generate income, and it's expressed as a rate of return on equity, ROE, or the return on the amount of money that you actually put out of your pocket. This is also referred to in real estate as return on cash invested. To use the market approach, you simply compare sales prices, not listing prices, in the area in recent months on a square foot basis. Get a multiple listings book from a friendly realtor and compare the actual sales prices received for various houses in the neighborhood that you're looking at. Divide the price by the number of square feet in the house. Add up 20 or 30 prices and average them to get a fairly accurate idea of what the house is worth on a per square foot basis. To use the cost approach, you must talk to home builders to find out how much it would cost them to duplicate the same size and quality of building today on a per square foot basis. Tell them that you're thinking of building a home in a particular community and ask the approximate prices that they would charge. To use the income approach, first of all, calculate the amount at which you could rent the property in today's market. Then, you add up all the expenses associated with owning a piece of property, including the following. First, mortgage payments, including principal and interest. Second, add up the taxes and all other charges payable that are associated with ownership, such as the homeowners association, condominium fees, and extra charges for garbage collection or utilities. Third, the regular cost of maintenance, such as paint and carpeting. Appliances in rental properties need to be replaced approximately every 7 years, and you must therefore build 1/7 of the cost of new appliances into your calculations as an expense on an annual basis. Also, deduct any other upkeep expenses that you, as the owner, will be responsible for. When you have a total of all these, you deduct this total from the income that the property will generate when rented to a tenant to get a net figure. You then divide your equity or cash investment into the net figure to get your rate of return. A general rule of residential real estate is that over time, a residence should rent for 1% of its market value, or conversely, it will sell for 100 times its monthly rent. This number holds true until you get into higher-priced homes, above $250,000, which seldom rent for enough even to pay the mortgage and taxes. It's for this reason that you only buy properties in the $100,000 price range. When you find a house that you decide is priced right because it has good potential to be upgraded and improved, or rented out as is, you then make an offer to purchase. The best deal for you when making an offer is a price no more than 90% of market value, with a small or nil cash down payment, with a first mortgage of 80 to 90% of the purchase price, and with the seller agreeing to carry the balance of the purchase price above the mortgage back over 5 to 7 years at an attractive rate of interest. A good strategy is to put in a lowball offer at first, to offer no more than 70% of the asking price, even though you know that most houses sell at between 80 and 95% of the asking price. Sometimes, for reasons you won't know, the seller will accept a ridiculously low offer. Perhaps he's just been transferred, or maybe the owners are going through a divorce or even a business bankruptcy, and they need the money immediately. Always ask why they're selling the house. Sometimes a little information can get you a long way. You should do a detailed calculation of how much you will have to spend to renovate before you make an offer on the house. Use your list of needed repairs and their cost to get the seller to come down in price. The better prepared you are, the more likely you are to drive a good bargain. Remember, you make your profit by buying right, and you only realize your profit by selling right. When you make a lowball offer, point out each deficiency that you have found in the house and give an estimate of how much it will cost you to repair or remedy this problem. Often, giving good reasons for offering a lower price will cause the seller to come down and accept less than he was asking. Take your time in negotiating a purchase. Your patience can save you hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. Again, never allow yourself to be rushed. If you get a complex counteroffer, ask for time to think it over and then sleep on it. Make your decision slowly and carefully. Once you've purchased the house, your aim is to fix it up or rent it out as quickly as possible. If you decide to fix it up, you will want to put your money where it goes the furthest in raising the rental or resale value of the house. Here are the key places to spend money in renovating and upgrading. At the top of the list is good quality paint, using what are called designer or decorator colors. Designer colors are those that go with any type of furniture and with any color scheme. Examples of designer colors are white, off-white, powder blue, cream, beige, or peach. This type of color is acceptable to almost everyone. No matter what type of furniture a person has, it will fit comfortably into a home that is done in designer colors. And, if warranted, paint the outside of the house as well as the inside. New paint can give you a payoff of as much as $5 for every dollar that you spend. This means that the value and resale price of the house will increase by $5 for every dollar that you invest in repainting the house inside and out. The second place to spend money is on carpets. Again, use designer colors, colors that are unobtrusive and which anyone can be comfortable with. Use better quality carpet in high traffic areas and cheaper carpets in bedrooms, dens, and basements. Be sure to use neutral tones and to use one color only throughout the entire house. Don't ever make the mistake of buying batches of carpet at bargain basement prices and then putting different colored carpet in different rooms. It looks terrible and ultimately lowers the value of the house, either for resale or rental. Every dollar that you spend on carpet will increase the value of the house by $4, a 400% return on your investment. The third place to invest is in landscaping. Clean up the yard and the outside of the house completely so that it makes a good impression on a person driving up to it for the first time. Real estate agents call this curb appeal. Many people have made the first half of their decision to buy or rent before they even come into the house, simply by the way the house looks on the outside. By investing in landscaping such as flowers and shrubbery, mowing the lawn and trimming the edges, you can increase the value of the house by as much as $25 for every dollar that you spend. The fourth place to invest is in fireplaces. According to real estate appraisers, fireplaces add $1.23 in value for every dollar that you spend. This is a good investment, even if you only put in a false gas fireplace. The fifth place to invest is to add a full bathroom. Another full bathroom increases the value of the house by $1.10 for every dollar that you spend on it. The sixth area is in new siding, which increases the value of the house dollar for dollar, as well as improving the appearance. Only use siding if you can't achieve the same effect with a good quality paint. Everything else that you do in renovating and upgrading the house will return you less than $1 for every dollar that you spend. For example, a minor kitchen remodel, which consists of new appliances, new paint and wallpaper, no matter how much it's needed, will give you back only 90 cents in added value for every dollar that you spend. This isn't to say that you shouldn't do it. An ugly kitchen will turn a buyer or renter off faster than almost anything else. A major kitchen remodel, as opposed to a minor kitchen remodel, which includes appliances, paint, and wallpaper, plus new cabinets and counters, will return you 89 cents for every dollar of cost. Sometimes you have no choice but to do a major kitchen remodel, but you should know that it is not increasing value, it is merely holding the value of the house. There are other things that you might do, all of which will add less than 90 cents per dollar that you spend, and sometimes much less. For example, you'll only get 80 cents of increased value for every dollar that you spend on new roofing. On new skylights, 75 cents for each dollar. For adding a wooden deck, 72 cents for every dollar. For installing a swimming pool, you'll only get back 32 cents for every dollar that you pay. Many home buyers consider a pool to be more of a nuisance than a benefit or an advantage. Whatever you do, don't put one in. And if you're buying a house, don't pay any more for the house than you would if it had no pool at all. So, to repeat, the most dependable improvements that you can make to add value to a house or an apartment in order are paint, carpet, landscaping, fireplaces, bathrooms, and new siding. This is where you should look when appraising a house for opportunities to upgrade and increase value. Of course, if there's repair work to be done on plumbing, electrical, or carpentry, you'll have to do these in any case. As I said earlier, make an estimate of all these costs that you feel will be necessary, and then use this estimate as a negotiating tool when you make your offer on the house. Once you've completed the facelift on the house, inside and out, you are ready to either refinance, sell, or rent out the house and move on to your next project. If you do this twice a year for the next 10 years, you'll probably be set for life. Financial success in real estate in the final analysis comes from leverage, or the use of OPM, other people's money, to multiply your return on your equity. However, real wealth creation comes from super leverage, which is based on five keys. Key number one to super leverage is that the house you are purchasing has a low price relative to the current market, and the lower the better. Any price that has a 20% discount or more from similar homes in the same area is the kind of bargain that can help to give you super leverage. The second key to super leverage is good terms, which means a low interest rate and payments stretched out over several years. In fact, if the key to finding real estate is location, 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 then the key to buying real estate, aside from price, is terms, terms, terms. You can pay almost any price within reason if you can have a long enough time to pay it off with low enough interest rates. The third key to super leverage is to get the vendor or seller to take back a second mortgage, thereby enabling you to get into the property with little or no cash out of your own pocket. The fourth key to super leverage is fast and aggressive upgrading of the property. Remember, time is money. Time is valuable. If you're going to purchase a house to fix up and rent out, get on with it. Do it fast. Move quickly. The faster you can turn the house around, the more valuable the whole transaction is to you. And the fifth key is refinancing and cashing out, getting your money back and owning the property with no investment at all. Using a simple example, imagine that you have purchased a house for $100,000. And by aggressively upgrading the house, you can increase its value to $120,000. Let us say that you took out an $80,000 first mortgage when you bought it, and you made a $20,000 down payment. You could now refinance the house with a $100,000 first mortgage, replacing the $80,000 first mortgage to get your $20,000 back. From that point on, you have the house with no equity investment at all. No matter what you earn from rentals, your rate of return on your investment, which is zero, is astronomical. This is super leverage. Now, once you get into the swing of buying, fixing, and renting, as well as managing single-family houses, you'll be ready to proceed to multifamily dwellings. And everything you just learned with regard to buying one house as an investment holds just as true for a duplex, triplex, fourplex, or an apartment building of any size. The only difference is the scale and the amount of money involved. The only limiting factors are your imagination and your resources. That's why it's better to start small and grow one step at a time, expanding your imagination, expanding your vision of what's possible for you, and, more important, increasing your knowledge and experience as you grow. Now, where do you find these properties to invest in? There are several sources of information on properties for sale. First, read all the real estate advertisements in the newspapers and in the smaller neighborhood papers. Even look on the bulletin boards in the supermarkets in the areas that you've decided are a good choice for purchasing residential property for investment. Second, drive through the neighborhood that you have chosen and take down the phone numbers of every house for sale, especially those listed for sale by owner. Third, contact every realtor in the area and tell them exactly what you're looking for, which is bargain properties with low down payments. Tell them that you're looking for people who need or want to sell in a hurry and that you're ready to make a decision quickly. Fourth, you can run your own ad asking for income-producing properties or saying something as simple as, "I buy houses, phone," and put your phone number in the ad. The fifth thing you can do is to have business cards printed with the title, "Real Estate Investor," on them and give them to everyone you talk to. Visit every bank in and around the area where you intend to invest. If there are community bulletin boards, write up a notice offering to buy homes and post it on every board, giving your phone number. Let's assume that you have gained some experience with single-family homes and that you're now ready to move up. How do you determine the right price for an apartment building? The answer is that you use all of the same methods that you have used in evaluating a single-family house. First, you compare the building on the basis of cost per apartment, or cost per apartment compared with other buildings of the same size and condition. You use the replacement cost method by finding out what it would cost to build this type of building starting from scratch. You use the market comparison method to find out how much similar apartment buildings are selling for on a per apartment, per square foot basis. You also use the return on equity method, which is perhaps the most important of all in evaluating whether or not this is a good purchase. You inspect every single unit in the apartment building, taking and keeping careful notes regarding the overall condition, the paint, the carpet, and the appliances. Be sure to find out how old the appliances are because, as you already know, they have to be replaced every 7 years, and the amount that they have depreciated already must be taken into consideration when calculating your offering price. Look at the expenses of operating the building before debt service or mortgage payments. Request complete and accurate numbers, including the bank book, with a listing of all the deposits entered and the checks written. The cost of operating an apartment building should be 30% of the gross or total rents received if the tenants pay the utilities themselves. The expenses of operation should be 40% of gross rent if the landlord pays the utilities directly. If either of these figures are off, either high or low, it could mean that the expenses have been understated or that the potential to reduce expenses and increase cash flow may exist. When looking at an apartment building for sale, always find out why the purchaser is selling. Get all the information possible about the seller's situation before you make an offer. It could be that he is asking for 20% cash down, but he really doesn't need that much cash all at once. Sometimes that much cash all at once would simply have to be paid in higher taxes, so it would be in his best interest to give you better terms, to lower the cash down payment and stretch the balance over 5 to 7 years. Remember, in any business, especially in investment real estate, cash is king. It's not just the most important thing, it's everything. Always think in terms of safeguarding your cash, parting with it slowly, grudgingly, carefully, and not at all if possible. Every offer to purchase an apartment building should be subject to verification of all revenues and expenses. If the owner is being straight with you, he will show you all records of rental receipts and expenses for the building going back several years. When negotiating with the seller, use all the building's shortcomings and defects to justify a low offer, but be polite, courteous, and low-key. Don't reveal your negotiating strategy to anyone, not even the real estate agent. Keep it to yourself. Keep it confidential. And here's an important point. Refuse to allow a real estate agent to carry offers back and forth between you and the seller of a piece of property. Insist on meeting with and negotiating directly with the property owner. If this isn't possible, you should probably keep on going, looking for a situation where it is possible. Your personal character and your ability to negotiate in your best interest is one of the most important assets that you have in purchasing apartment property. Have an engineer check all the main plumbing, the boilers and the furnaces, and the wiring before you finalize the deal. Have a builder check the structure for soundness. Have an exterminator check for termites or pests of any kind. Remember, you have to approach this property as though you're going to keep it for 20 years. Besides, every single flaw that you can find gives you additional ammunition that you can use to get the price down. Purchasing commercial real estate of any kind requires careful thought and analysis. Just remember that you're buying the long-term future earning power of a piece of property, and you must evaluate each opportunity carefully by asking the following questions. First, how much is it going to cost you in comparison with other properties of equal attractiveness which are for sale in the same area? The second question is, how much do you get back? What will be your net return on your investment after deducting every conceivable expense? The third question is, when will you begin to get a return on your money? It's not uncommon for commercial properties to sell at zero cash flow because they're so attractive. An investor will purchase a piece of property where the income from rentals just covers the payments on the mortgages. The investor will do this in anticipation of being able to raise the rents with the passing of time and eventually get back the money and higher cash flow in the next 5 or 10 years. You need to be alert to this tradition in the buying and selling of apartment properties. The fourth question is, how certain is it that your return on an investment will materialize? Every investment contains a certain element of risk and uncertainty. Real estate entrepreneurs are successful to the degree to which they minimize risk rather than seek out risk. Be very cold-blooded when evaluating how and when you will get your money back once you've put it in. And fifth, a key question in investing is, what else can you do with the same amount of money? Where else can you invest the same amount of money to get a similar or greater return? Many people consider this question carefully before selling any investment. If you sell an investment that is giving you a return of 10% per annum, you have to decide where else you could invest the money to achieve the same return on investment with the same level of risk. All this is food for thought if you're planning to become a real estate entrepreneur, starting with single-family homes and moving up to duplexes, triplexes, and apartment complexes. In this brief discussion, I've deliberately not talked about things such as equity buildup, depreciation or amortization rates, the impact of taxes, or discounted cash flows. The fact is that you should only buy a piece of property that makes sense as an investment, never a piece of property that only makes sense because of the tax benefits attached to it. What we've talked about in this session are the basics that you need to know to get started as a real estate entrepreneur. There are many books, courses, and seminars in this subject, and I recommend that you get them, read them, and in the case of the seminars, attend them. As with any business, real estate investment requires an enormous amount of time and energy, dedication, courage, and persistence. Not only that, but you really must enjoy it if you're going to succeed at it. It must be something that you really, really love to do. You must be willing to put your head down for several years, work hard, wrestle with unruly bankers and sellers, negotiate, grind, compromise continually, and fight with difficult tenants who feel that all landlords are fair game. However, if you persevere in spite of these challenges, one day you could wake up with a substantial portfolio of income-producing properties, a healthy cash flow, and financial independence for life.